You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn about the Victory Garden Initiative in Milwaukee that's working to build communities in the city by helping people grow their own food. Now, have you ever wanted to just drop everything, hop in a car, a plane, a boat, and just go? That's what our next guest did in a single-engine trawler boat. Their journey took over a year and more than 6,000 miles long. It's called America's Great Loop, a giant loop through rivers, waterways, and open ocean that takes you around the eastern part of the United States. Jill and James Iverson started that journey where they live in Manitowoc and ended the trip there this past September. I recently talked with both of them. Here's a listen to that conversation. James, can you briefly tell us what America's Great Loop is?
Well, you kind of described it well in your introduction. It's a circumnavigation of the eastern third of the United States and part of Canada. And it's about 6,000 miles long. It includes going through about 106 locks. And there's voyages on the Great Lakes, on the rivers, on the Gulf of Mexico, and the Atlantic Ocean.
Wow. And Jill, I imagine you don't just hop in your boat and do this. What kind of planning and preparation went into this trip?
Well, we did do some planning. We're longtime cruisers, I should tell you that. So maybe we didn't have to do quite as much planning as people that are brand new to boating. And there are people that do the loop with very little experience, but we've been boating for decades. So, but to get ready for this trip, we did some planning, but not too much because we really like to be spontaneous and make plans along the way as we go.
I want to ask each of you a favorite part of the trip, and I know it'll be hard to pick just one, but what's something that stood out in your mind? Jill, let's start with you.
Okay. Although I loved big, you know, New York City and being alongside the Statue of Liberty, I have to say St. John's River was really, really special. It's old Florida, old world Florida. So we took a 150-mile side trip off the loop from Jacksonville, Florida, and went all the way down the state, down the middle of the state. And we were especially excited to anchor out behind Pontoon State Park on the Dead River. It was like a jungle. We were surrounded at night using our beam. We saw alligator eyes and we heard limpkins, which are birds that scream and sound like someone being murdered. People actually call 911 when they
wow.
hear these birds. And wood storks, who are huge storks that can clack through bones. So we felt like we were in Jurassic Park. It was wonderful. We stayed an extra 2 days.
Wow. And James, did you have another favorite part?
Yeah, I have to say, as much as I love the St. John's River, one of the highlights for me was anchoring out right next to the Statue of Liberty
wow.
and spending the night there and watching the lights of the city wink on at night and just being surrounded by it all. And the statue itself is such an iconic thing. We've all seen photographs of it, but to be anchored right next to it was quite a thrill for me.
And Jill, I might think, you know, you're in a boat, just the two of you. It might be kind of like isolating, but reading up on what you did, it sounds like there's a really strong feeling of community and you met a lot of interesting people along the way.
Oh, we really did. First of all, especially on the rivers, you really build relationship with the other loopers because you all have to go through the locks. And by the way, we went through 106 locks on these trips. So you all have to go through the locks and you all have to tie up to a wall or a marina or anchor. So we kept running into the same people and building relationships. We also built relationships with a lot of local people. We went out of our way to meet local people everywhere we went. And we also stayed in touch with our dear friends via social media. I don't know what I would do without Instagram and Facebook. We really, since we didn't go home for a whole year, it was really important that people kept in touch with us and we kept in touch with people. And we felt like we had our little 33-foot boat was filled with a couple of hundred good friends.
And James, you both mentioned the locks. I like locks. I like just watching, you know, standing on the shore and watching boats go through them. 106, though, did you ever get tired of locks or were they still cool after, you know, number 105?
Well, they're, they're physically kind of demanding. And sometimes you have to wait because pleasure boats are the lowest priority in locks. Commercial traffic has purse dibs on a transit through the locks. And so, you know, sometimes, especially on the rivers, on the Mississippi River, I had to wait several hours at a lock in order to get through. And, you know, the surface of Lake Michigan is about 579 feet above sea level. So in order to get from here to the Atlantic Ocean, you have to go down 579 feet, which means a lot of locks. And then to get back, you have to go up 579 feet. So you're transiting all sorts of locks. But I'll tell you what, the people that operate the locks are public servants in the best sense. They were all very nice and very professional, and we always had wonderful experiences with them.
And so I got to ask, as we wrap up, you were gone for well over a year. You said you were in social media contact with people. What was homecoming like, though, getting back home and seeing everybody and starting to settle back in?
Well, I would say, like in The Wizard of Oz, like Dorothy said, there's no place like home. It was just wonderful to get back home and see all our friends and family and to reintegrate ourselves into our community once again.
And Jill, your thoughts on homecoming?
Well, you know, we didn't get to see our grown sons for a whole year and their ladies. And they came down and caught the lines for us. We also had James and I put some bucks on the bar at the Stage Door Pub, the Irish pub in our town, and everyone came out and had a beer with us. And, you know, it was very, very touching. I have to say, in a lot of ways, you know, we came back different people from this trip, and I'd say even better people. You know, just really appreciating all the people in our lives and appreciating our country. It looks a lot better from the water when you don't see strip malls and you don't have to ride on a bunch of ugly highways. You know, it's a pretty wonderful country. And Canada, we love so much. Our Canadian friends are so important to us. So, you know, it's great to be home. Not to say we won't have another adventure, because we've got some planned.
Thank you both so much for joining us, and congratulations on completing the trip. We've been talking to Jill and James Iverson. They live in Manitowoc. They recently completed a year-plus journey around the eastern part of the U.S. on their boat. It's called The Great Loop. They're in the process of writing a book about the experience. And you can find more info on their Instagram page. You've got a link at WPR.org/Central Time. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a bipartisan group of political observers in La Crosse who have made bets on elections for nearly 50 years.
At Houghton's Restaurant near Viterbo University in La Crosse, a group of seven people gather around a table filled with Friday fish fry specials and pints of beer. This is a group of one-time political heavy hitters from the La Crosse area. They gather around election time each year to talk politics and bet on the outcome of elections. The current group includes a former Republican state Senate president and a Democrat who is a former president of the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents.
I have been the absolute loser. I have been the absolute winner. And I believe that today I'm one of the absolute winners.
Walter Baltz of West Salem has been a longtime supporter of Republican candidates. He's also the only living founder of this little-known group, which calls itself the Select Committee on Election Predictions. Baltz used to have lunch in La Crosse in the late 1970s with a radio personality and a doctor. The conversation would often turn to politics.
And we'd argue as to who was going to be the winner of the upcoming elections. And I finally got tired of so much baloney, and I said, the only way to get people to be honest about this is to put some money on it.
The Select Committee has operated largely in obscurity over the years. The only mention of the group was in a New York Times article on the 1988 presidential election. While Baltz can't pinpoint when the group started, the Times article says it was in 1978. Few rules govern the wagering the Select Committee does, except that they place bets at least twice a year during the April and November general elections.
Anyone who was not a winner but was not the absolute loser each one of those people would have to pay $5 to the absolute winner. The absolute loser had to buy lunch for everyone at the next event.
Dick Record, what are you doing on the congressional race?
On this particular morning, it's the Friday before the November general election, and the group is picking winners in the statewide and local races.
It's Brad Paff and Ben Orton.
Key national elections, like the U.S. Senate races in Georgia and Pennsylvania, are also on the ballot in case there's a tie. University of Wisconsin La Crosse Emeritus Political Scientist Joe Heim has been a voting member and the Select Committee's record keeper since the 1980s.
I think all of us enjoy the camaraderie and the political discussions. I think we all respect each other. We come from all sorts of different backgrounds, but we all seem to have contact with political circles and political activities.
Former La Crosse mayor and longtime Democratic state representative John Mettinger has been a winner and a loser in the 20 years he's been part of the group. He says politics might be better today if people with different ideas sat down and talked with each other, like the Select Committee does.
With this group, we're here to be honest, and that's why sometimes when we go down the list of people running for office, we wind up picking people that we don't like at all, but we figure that they're going to win.
Walter Balt says when the group started, there were just three members. The loser used to have to pay for lavish meals, including caviar, steaks, and champagne. Now, the loser pays for fish fry and beer. These days, there are eight members, and the group will consider adding new members, including its first woman. WPR's John Davis wrote and produced this story. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, during World War II, people around the U.S. turned their yards into victory gardens to help supply food. Find out about a victory garden program happening now in Milwaukee. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. When we think about farms and gardens, we might think of rural Wisconsin. But a group in Milwaukee is bringing food production into urban environments and building community along the way. The organization is called the Victory Garden Initiative. Sandra Jones is executive director of the Victory Garden Initiative in Milwaukee. She's retired from the faculty of the Department of African and African Diaspora Studies at UW-Milwaukee, and she's the author of the book Voices of Milwaukee, Bronzeville. Sandra, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you tell us about the mission of the Victory Garden Initiative?
The mission of the Victory Garden Initiative is very simple. We want to teach people how to grow their own healthy organic food. We want to build, we want to introduce gardening into the community in a sustainable way, a sustainable and just way.
And can you introduce us to the community you're serving? Where are most of your efforts focused?
Okay. Victory Garden Initiative sits in the Harambe neighborhood in the heart of Milwaukee's Black community, African-American community. It's one of the poorest communities in the state. It's a food desert within the boundary of Harambe, which is from Capitol Drive to North Avenue, 20th Street to Holton Avenue in the city of Milwaukee. There are no grocery stores, no major food markets. So you have corner stores, you have dollar stores, and that kind of thing. So it's what is considered a food desert. Well, we are an acre and a half urban organic farm that sits right in the middle of that community. And our aim is to provide healthy organic produce and food to the people in the community. We want to make sure that food is accessible and above all that it is free. So everything we grow, we have programs designed to distribute that food. People can come to the farm and pick what they need, or And we're developing a program that actually takes that food out into the community.
And as I understand it, you're working with volunteers from that community to grow the food in the first place?
Indeed. We have hundreds of volunteers that come and support the farm and the various programs that we have. And let me tell you a little bit about those programs.
Sure.
In 2008, Gretchen Mead actually founded Victory Garden Initiative, and she founded it by her and a group of community members decided that they wanted to build garden boxes in people's backyards. And so they started out with 35. They built 35 garden boxes that first year. As of last year, we have built over 6,000 garden beds in people's backyard, in churchyards, in schoolyards, for other nonprofit organizations across the city. We build those boxes, and again, hundreds and hundreds of volunteers come and help us construct and put together those boxes. We fill it with organic dirt. We provide seeds, and we also provide instruction to people who need it on how to grow their own healthy food.
What do you hear from people who are maybe for the first time growing food in their own garden, or, you know, taking home food that they helped grow at the acre and a half of farm you were talking about?
What I hear is, you know, there is nothing like when you're in your kitchen cooking your dinner, going out to the garden to get what you need. There's nothing like it. The food that you grow yourself does not, it doesn't have chemicals. We don't use any chemicals on the farm. All of our food is organic, and that's what we teach to the community. And so people appreciate that. Not to mention the health benefits that they gain, that people gain from growing their own food. And that's the thing that we hear. We have other programs too. The Blitz, the annual Blitz, is our signature program, but we also have programs for young people. We have a YEP program. It's called Youth Education Program, where we actually go into MPS schools and work with children in after school and summer programs, teaching them. We build boxes on the schoolyard, and we teach them how to grow food. And not only that, we have cooking programs. We have a chef and trainings program, for example, and with our YET program that teach kids how to prepare the foods that they grow. And a lot of it, you know, is new to them. A lot of the fresh vegetables, you know, that kind of thing. I had a young person on the farm last year or this past year. We have a lot of fruit trees on the farm. And I called a group of them over, and the young man pulled a plum from the tree. And he said, "I have never in my life eaten a fresh piece of fruit off a tree that I picked." So, you know, it's very rewarding when you hear things like that. And when you understand that this program is designed to give these skills to people, to young people, that they will take with them throughout their life. Another program that we have is our Victory Garden Urban Farm Market Table. Hmm. So at least once a week. But first, let me say that the farm is open 24/7, so people can come into the farm and pick what they need to eat. And we grow everything. We grow corn and potatoes. We grow collard greens and kale and cucumbers and broccoli and tomatoes and everything. And people can come in and pick what they need. But we also set up a food stand, a roadside food farm stand. Our motto is pay what you can. And if you don't have any money, take what you need. Mm-hmm. And that is also a very popular program that we offer at the Victory Garden Initiative.
Sandra, we just have a minute or so left, Sandra. No. I just wanted to ask, it's winter, it's a great planning time. You've got a lot going on already. What is on your mind as you look toward 2023 and the growing season, just in our last minute or so?
In the last minute, what we really want to do, it's one thing to grow the food and have it available for people to come and pick what they need at the farm. But we also need to develop a distribution system for that food. So we want to make contacts with, schools and churches so that we can bring that healthy food to the people who need it the most.
Sandra, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
All right. Thank you for having me.
That's Sandra Jones, Executive Director of the Victory Garden Initiative in Milwaukee. We talked through today about the efforts to bring local food production into Wisconsin's biggest city. If you want to learn more about the Victory Garden Initiative, we have a link. You can find it over at WPR.org/Central Time. That's WPR.org/Central Time. Check that out for more information about lots of the conversations we have here on the show, articles, reports, recipes, and more. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, homelessness often gets blamed on things like poverty or addiction. The author of a new book joins the show to tell us there's a more fundamental problem, not enough housing in many communities around the state and around the country. We'll look at the problem and possible solutions that communities are trying. And what happened to air travel over the holidays? We'll look at the Southwest Airlines meltdown, some lessons for the future, and you can get us started right now. Did you travel by air over the last 2 or 3 weeks? Did it go well? Did it go poorly? Either way, we want to hear from you. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Tell us your air travel story over the holidays, for better or for worse. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then it can feel like the debate over American history and how we teach it is getting increasingly contentious. But are Americans actually divided in reality? We'll talk to the head of a polarization research group about their new report called Defusing the History Wars. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll check out some of the most interesting TV shows of 2022 and take a look ahead at the new year in television. First, it can feel like U.S. history classes have gotten more contentious and political. In just the last 2 years, dozens of states have introduced bills to limit what teachers can say in the classroom about things like race and inequality. That's according to the New York Times. But are people actually divided over how to teach the country's history? Our next guest says way less divided than we might think. And he says we get a lot of stuff wrong when it comes to what people with different political views think about teaching American history. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you want to see U.S. history taught in schools? Do you think someone with different political beliefs would have a different answer than you? Do you feel like U.S. history classes are more contentious today? Has there been a controversy over how things are taught in your own community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Dan Vallone is the U.S. Director for More in Common, a nonpartisan group that studies polarization. Their latest report is titled Defusing the History Wars, Finding Common Ground in Teaching America's National Story. Dan, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. It's great to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about why your group tackled what you call the history wars in this new report?
Sure. So we have been doing research on how Americans think about American identity for the past several years, doing a lot of interviews and focus groups with Americans from across the country. And something we noticed earlier this year in 2022 was that the intensity that people described the conversations they were seeing in their community about how to teach American history was increasing, that things seemed to be getting much worse. People were referencing things they saw on television about various curriculum, or history was coming up more and more and more. And so we wanted to explore this to see what is the reality here, because clearly it's people are seeing a conflict and there's smoke, but is there actually fire there? And so that led us to then lead a series of national surveys to produce the report that you just referenced, which I'm happy to go more into detail, but that's the kind of origin story here.
And the nutshell, I think what can come out, I think, in the media sometimes when we go online is one side says, hey, that other side only wants to teach the negative stuff, the bad stuff about American history. The other side says, the other side wants to whitewash and ignore all the bad stuff about American history. So you went out and asked people, what do you want to see in American history classes? There's a lot more agreement than we might, than I might have expected.
That, and you, your summary is absolutely right, Rob. Basically, most Americans overwhelmingly believe that we should teach both the good and the bad about our history. We should try and be fact-based and objective. We should scrutinize our failures, particularly those around racial injustice and discrimination, while also celebrating and elevating our successes and our story of progress. That is a non-controversial perspective that most Americans hold. But at the same time, most Americans are convinced that we are divided into two hostile camps with irreconcilable views on how to teach history. So we can't see this common ground, even though it is very significant and widely held.
Now, one of the most interesting parts of this report, as I read it, and it's a little hard to sum up easily, but you asked, you know, Democrats, what do you think Republicans want taught? And Republicans, what do you think Democrats want taught? And then compared it to what people actually said. Can you tease that out a little bit and spell out what you found when you did that?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, Robin. It gets a little tricky sometimes. So this is what we refer to as a perception gap, which is the difference between what somebody actually believes and what I think they believe. So to take it to the simplest level, 93% of Republicans feel that Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks should be taught as exemplars who fought for equality. Democrats think that only 38% of Republicans hold that view. So that's almost an over a 50-point perception gap that Democrats have about Republicans' views. And the same phenomena we manifest in terms of how Republicans think Democrats want to see history taught. So 92% of Democrats feel that all students should learn how the Constitution and Declaration of Independence advance freedom and equality. But Republicans think that only 45% of Democrats feel that way. So again, a massive perception gap across the board in terms of how we misunderstand what other Americans want to see in terms of history being taught. And the issue with these perception gaps is it's not that we don't have disagreements. We do, and we get into them in the report, and they're important and they're significant, but we would be so much better able to grapple with our genuine disagreements if we could puncture these misperceptions, if we could reduce the toxicity that these kinds of misperceptions feed, because this is a really important topic. It's our national history. It's something that most Americans feel very strongly about. And so we really want to get at the actual substance of where we disagree and build on all the things that we agree on.
Talking to Dan Vallone with the group More in Common. Their new report is called Defusing the History Wars, Finding Common Ground in Teaching America's National Story. A lot about how we don't understand each other and what we want in schools. More agreement than we might think if we looked at arguments online or in the media. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. What do you want to see taught in American history classes? Do you teach history? Has it been difficult for you to decide what you can and can't teach about? And do you think people, whoever you are, do you think people get your views on these things wrong? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Dan, where does this misperception come from? What's driving this thing where we think everybody on the other side has the most extreme view we see on the other side?
Yeah, so we've done perception gap studies before. So this is a methodology that we've deployed previously. And what we typically find is that things like media sources, so the information that you consume, the news you consume, the television you watch, the social media sites that you spend time on, those all influence your views about what other Americans believe. Your social circle also has a huge influence, right? So what are you actually getting in terms of when you talk to people? Are you talking to people with different political views? Are you talking with people who hold the same view as yourself? So information sources, your social network, are two of the biggest drivers typically of what forms our impressions about other Americans' beliefs. The interesting thing with this report, Rob, in previous studies, we found that there was a correlation between intensity of political engagement and the magnitude of perception gap. So basically, the more politically active somebody was, the larger their perception gap was on average. So the more inaccurate they were about other Americans' views. We didn't have that finding with this report. Everybody, irrespective of whether you are hyper-engaged in politics or not engaged at all, has roughly the same size perception gap, and they are all very large. So this entire debate is really anchored to a significant degree, in complete misperception.
There are people who have these fundamental disagreements. You look at different social groups in the U.S., but you say when it comes to numbers, the people on the extremes of their opinions on how American history should be taught, they're in a substantial minority. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we produced a report in 2018 called Hidden Tribes, a study of America's polarized landscape, where we used a statistical process to identify seven distinct segments of the American population. So basically, we categorized Americans into these seven segments. And four of the segments we describe as the exhausted majority. And this is the majority of Americans. They hold more complex views. They're less political in their orientation to life, and they're less involved in politics. And then we have what we describe as the wings. So these are very vocal segments of the population who are particularly prominent on cable news, on social media, and in actual politics. So in this report on the history wars, what we find is that it is these wing segments whose voices and whose views are being mistaken as majority views for both the Democrats and the Republicans in this context. So again, very vocal minorities of Americans are being presented as the majority of Democrats and Republicans, when in fact that is not remotely true. And their views are significantly different from those of the exhausted majority, where we find abundant common ground.
And before we go to our callers, Dan, in addition to surveys, you did some in-depth interviews with nine Americans, sort of a deep focus group sort of in this report. What sorts of things did you hear from them?
Yeah, we always like to do a lot of qualitative research, a lot of focus groups and interviews, because it's so important to hear how Americans are actually experiencing this in their own words. A few themes emerged from these conversations. One is the real strong concern that there is an agenda, a political agenda at play here. And so, Tina, a white Republican woman from South Carolina, she's seeing news about critical race theory and about all these kind of anti-American curriculum efforts. And yet when she talks to her kid, who's a student, he has no experience with that. Nothing in the school is actually about that. And so she doesn't know what to believe anymore, and she's concerned there is an agenda at play. And similarly, when we talk to Democrats like Chanda, which is Indian American from Texas, she doesn't want students to feel shame or guilt, but she wants to learn, and she doesn't want to have there be an agenda to prevent them from learning, even about things that we have failed. So this concern about political agendas really cuts across the ideological lines, and it's something we hear a lot. And then the second, and it's we touch on this a bit in the report, but this is always personal, right? So people, when we talk about American history, when you start asking people questions, their first response is typically about the country's history writ large. But then by the time they get into their second or third responses, they start sharing their personal history as well. And so I think when we work with our partners, we always want to help them think about bringing this down to family and individual stories, because that is what American history is ultimately made of. And nobody wants to have their own personal history be misunderstood. And they want to feel as if their history, the history of their families, et cetera, is being taught in a way that is authentic and represents the reality.
We're talking to Dan Vallone, U.S. Director for the nonpartisan research group More in Common, with us today to talk about a new report called Defusing the History Wars. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen history become a controversy in your own community? Or is that something you hear about on the news, but not a big deal where you live? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about perception versus reality when it comes to American history, how it's taught in schools, and what we think other people with different political views think about that issue. Dan Vallone is with us from the research group More in Common, looking at their recent report called Defusing the History Wars. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe even your own experiences as a student or teacher or parent or you name it. Call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. We've got Jeff with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. Happy New Year, gentlemen.
And to
very
you.
Very good topic. Yeah, thank you. I learned at a very young age that we really carry our history with us. In the third grade, I was learning about the Suez Canal, and I came home, and my mother told me that my great-grandmother was an immigrant from Sweden who worked for Martin Pattison. And to me, that was a more interesting historical fact. And as I grew older, I started to explore more about local history, my own family involvement in it, as well as the national history. And I firmly believe that American history is not just political history, because Black history is American history, for example.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Dan, I think tying it into that actually connects to what you're just saying about how people tie it into their own family stories and their own lives.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, Jeff. And we hear that a lot in focus groups, how whatever theme in American history, people actually experience it most intimately through their own personal story or their own family story. And so although the debate often focuses on kind of abstract terms, a better way to disrupt the polarization is to try and ask people about their family stories, to get at these local stories, because it's much harder to politicize something when it's about families and individuals and when somebody feels as if their personal story is being heard and respected. And so, you know, one of the strategies we recommend to groups when you're trying to disrupt some of the polarization is take things out of the national context, place them in a local context, speak to family, speak to individual stories, and try and avoid having the national politics be the only thing that is discussed.
Jeff, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us now in Racine. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Thank you. I wanted to make a comment about the survey that you just mentioned. I'm wondering if you drill down on that question, like you might find out that people had different ideas, for instance. Well, people may want to say it's fine for someone to teach about Martin Luther King Jr., but what you got into what your Martin Luther King Jr.'s ideas, like civil disobedience or the evils of slavery and how that persists in society today, that you get into those issues, they would not agree. So I wonder if your survey kind of drilled into more specific issues of the type of thing there seems to be, that they may not want those things taught.
I gotcha, Jim. Thanks for the call. And Dan, I've seen that concern before, that people are willing to accept what people say might be a sanitized version of, say, Martin Luther King Jr., and not, as Jim says, dig too deep into what he was calling for.
You know, it's a really important point, so thank you for raising it, Jim. And there's a phenomena that scientists call false concurrence, which is this idea that we would be presenting a false degree of agreement. And so what I would say is to a certain degree, yes, I think you're very right, Jim, that the more specific we would get, the more disagreement you would see happen in people's responses. That's a generalizable phenomenon in most kind of public opinion research. The more specific you get, you tend to lose some of the kind of agreement scores across the board. I think in this context, with Martin Luther King, for example, or about American history more generally, I think you are also right that as we got more specific about a particular curriculum, for example, you might see more disagreement. But and that's important, but I also would just caveat it to say, we're not even having those good disagreements right now. We feel locked in disagreements about whether or not we can teach the history of slavery, for example, whether or not we can teach about the Constitution and the way that it propelled the independence and freedom in the country and across the globe. And so what we are trying to do with this report is not to gloss over the real disagreements or to say that anything about this is simple, but it's to say we need to be having we need to be having better conversations, both about the things that we actually disagree on And it's always better to build on what you do agree on, which there is definitely more than people think exists.
Thanks for the call, Jim. We're talking to Dan Vallone from the group More in Common, looking at their recent report on how we teach American history in our schools. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Linda joins us now in Plymouth. Linda, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, when your guest was speaking about when you share your personal story, it is difficult to make it political. And within my family, that is not the case, because I was sharing because I'm going to write my personal story, how I worked through my trauma with my mother and how I healed that. And as I was starting to share that, they were thinking I was talking politically. And they got really mad, and it has caused a major, major rift, because they could not separate how I was feeling about my experience. They couldn't separate it from my personal experience about their political views.
Mm. Linda, thanks for the call. Dan, I mean, sometimes, things don't work out so smoothly, even when we start to talk at that family level.
No, and I appreciate that you sharing that, Linda. That must be very difficult. And it does speak to the fact that, you know, politics has so saturated so much of our life. It is hard to sometimes separate it out and create that space. And something that I think all, you know, community groups, civic groups, civil society more generally, we need to do more to create spaces where we can try and pull and create separation from politics and from conversations about how we teach history, for example.
Thanks again for that call, Linda. I want to take our last couple minutes, Dan, to talk about what we do about this. You've started to give us some hints along the way. How can we take this information about our misperceptions about each other and how we teach history and maybe dial down some of the smoke going on in a lot of our communities?
Yeah, sure. So there's just three, we provide a number of recommendations in the report. And so there's just three things that I'll highlight now. The first is I would encourage everyone to go to the website, historyperceptiongap.us. We have a wide variety of resources to share, to circulate, because the first recommendation we have is we need to elevate these perception gaps to dispel the illusion. Basically, we want to highlight like, oh, we have a lot of misperceptions that are fueling this debate and enabling what we refer to in the report as conflict entrepreneurs to pull us apart. So let's elevate the reality here and try and dispel some of these misperceptions. So would encourage folks to go to the website, download the resources, share them, and use them in conversations and community. The second thing is at the community level, we need to do more to build cross-cutting coalitions to establish better norms for how communities will debate issues that are contentious, like how to teach history. And so the best way to do this is to have Democrats, Republicans, independents, non-political folks band together to try and say we don't agree on how to teach history, but we all agree that we need to set parameters for what is permissible and what's impermissible in terms of how we debate this. We're not going to allow any dehumanization. We're not going to allow any toxicity to come into our debate. And we're going to have a healthy dialogue and discourse about how do we teach history. And the third thing is at the individual level. And Rob, you actually spoke to this earlier in one of the prompts that you were saying, which is something to the effect of, do you feel like your views are misrepresented? Mm-hmm. And so when you're having these conversations, we really encourage, start with that prompt. Rather than saying, do you agree or disagree with X, Y, or Z issue, ask people, do you feel like your views are accurately understood by others? It kind of takes the tension out of the air and allows people to have a much more humane conversation.
Dan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Really enjoyed it. Appreciate it.
That's Dan Vallone. You too. That's Dan Vallone, U.S. Director for More in Common, a group that studies polarization. He was with us today to talk about a report the group released last month. It's called Defusing the History Wars, Finding Common Ground in Teaching America's National Story. Coming up after the news, have you seen any good new TV shows lately? A Wisconsin TV expert shares some of his favorite shows of 2022, ones he's looking forward to this year, and you can share yours too. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
We'll be right back.